And I alone am thinking, like, what is wrong with you people? Like, this is not good news.
Hey, CNFers. Discover your story with Bay Path University's fully online MFA and creative nonfiction writing. Faculty have true passion and love for their work. Shines through with every comment, edit, and reading assignment. The instructors are available to answer all your questions, and their years of experience as writers and teachers have made for an unbeatable experience. Head over to baypath.edu/MFA for more information. And it's about time. It's about time we do this. What do you say? Yeah, so Adrienne Brodeur is my guest today. She's the author of Wild Game, a memoir about her mother and her mother's lover. It's about secrets, man. It's a damn good read. By the way, I'm Brendan O'Mara, and this is the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, the show where I talk to badass writers and filmmakers about the craft of telling true stories. That's it. Is that it? No. Hey, registration's open for Hippocamp 2020. No more early birds are available. I guess they sold out in like record time. Amazing. The worms are gone. The early birds got the damn worm. But there's ways you can still save some dough, CNFers. Visit hippocamp20.hippocampusmagazine.com and use the promo code CNFPOD2020 to get $40 off your fee. In fact, I think I'm going to use the promo code myself to get that $40 off. That's going to buy me some beer. That $40 is going to buy me some beer at the Thursday night social hour. You're going to want to be there for that. It's where I met Damon Brown, guest of show last week, 189. If I wasn't there at that bar, I would have never met Damon, one presumes. Anyway, best money you'll spend on a conference this year, I promise you. In any case, I want to read to you a nice review the show got over on Apple Podcasts. If you leave a kind review, an honest review, I'll be sure to read it on the air here. It means a lot for the show and the show's packaging and the show's validation, and it kind of just builds community around the show to have that kind of validation, especially if people are passing through. Your time is finite, and seeing those reviews are like, you know, you read those, you see them, you see some new ones, you see some fresh ones, you're like, all right, if you're a passerby, I might give the show a shot. And you guys know it, you dig it, you dig what we're up to. So this is my way of giving you that shout out, and I want to show my appreciation for you by giving the best of shout outs here in the intro. So Louise Socal, she wrote, "Delightful, quirky, informative. Creative nonfiction is my true love for both reading and writing, and in Brendan and the CNF podcast, I can tell I found a kindred soul. I love his passion for all things CNF that comes through in the interviews, and I always get something out of them. Brendan obviously does his homework before talking with each guest, and it shows. But he's also not afraid to show his personality, which is refreshing." Thank you, Louise Socal. That was awful sweet. Digital fist bumps from me to you. So I'm getting ready to pitch a story or two. There isn't a whole lot of time left in the day, what with the day job that's sort of killing me, the reading, the research, and production of this podcast, of course, this marketing seminar I'm in the middle of, which is very labor-intensive, and then finding the time to drink my stress away. There just isn't that much time left in the day. So that's where I'm at. Oh, that reminds me. Hey, we all need editors. We all need editing. We all need accountability, man. If you've got an essay or a book that needs coaching, I'd be honored and thrilled to serve you and your work. You can email me, brendan@brendanomera.com. Hey, hey. And let's start a conversation, because the world, trust me, the world needs your work. We need you to show up, and I'd love to help. So, like I said, pardon, Adrienne Brodeur is here. She's a pretty special person, and she wrote a great book, Wild Game, and it got a tremendous amount of coverage and press. I mean, just Google her, and you'll see her TV spots, New York Times, poets and writers. I mean, it's all over. Great stuff, pretty impressive. But it was nice because after we were done, she emailed me and said, it's nice when you forget when you're being interviewed, which is kind of the best compliment a guy like me hosting a pod like this can hear. So here we go. Adrienne Brodeur, episode 190.
Sort of a literary heritage, and that my father was a writer for The New Yorker. He started out his life as a novelist and went on to become, you know, a nonfiction writer for The New Yorker. And so it was always, and my mother was a food and travel writer, so it was always part of my, the world I inhabited. But of course, you know, I rejected it too. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I thought I wanted no part of it. I actually wasn't a big reader as a child. I mean, I read as kids read, and I, you know, had a decent education and everything else. So I read a lot of books for school and so on, but I was never one of those children who was under the blanket with the flashlight or that kind of thing. But I did grow up in that world, and it took me a long time to circle back and inhabit it of my own free will as an adult. When I went off to college and school, I was much more of the mind that I was going to, you know, sort of do good work and save the world. And I went on into a career in politics at first, in government, and then realized over in my 20s, when I really did start reading voraciously, sort of realized I was watching the pile of political journals or public policy journals shrink as the literary journals on my bedside table rose, and I felt an overwhelming pull towards literature.
Yeah, and it was your father's second wife, your stepmother, who was really influential in terms of that literary taste, correct?
Yes. I mean, actually, she was she was his third wife, my second stepmother. Mm-hmm. Both my stepmothers were in the literary world in some capacity or another. But that stepmom, who's Margot in the book, owned a beautiful independent bookstore in San Diego, California, or in Del Mar. And I remember from the very first time I met her before she and my father were married that she would just press novels and memoir and poetry, just all sorts of wonderful books into my hands. And she really ignited that passion in me. And I just, you know, it was such an eye-opening time in my life because I had, gotten myself into a whole lot of trouble with where I was just emotionally and in my own life and not having enough agency in my own life. And she just intuited it on some level, but she would give me these books that often sort of featured a young female protagonist sort of working her way out of a situation. And in that way that reading is such a fundamentally empathetic act, you know, you put yourself in someone else's, some character's head, and you go from there. I think it, in these very subtle and profound ways, sort of allowed me to see a way out.
Isn't that something that's just so cool that somehow certain books can just kind of turn a switch on for you? Isn't it?
It's just, absolutely.
Do you remember some of those first titles that, you know, Margot, as she's known in the book, gave to you, and you're like, oh wow, this is
I do. I mean, I remember that. I think it was the very first batch were three books, and it included Jim Harrison. This is all fiction, but Jim Harrison's Dalva, Barbara Kingsolver, and I can't remember whether it was The Bean Tree or Animal Dreams, and Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. And yeah, I mean, such different books. But, you know, just that struggle of sort of being on the wrong path, getting on the right, I mean, that's oversimplifying, but sort of finding your way, which I think most books shed some light on.
Looking at your father's career, that he was a novelist turned journalist, usually it's kind of the other way around. Usually journalists, they kind of like they do their assignment work, and then they pivot to novels as a way to sort of scratch that artistic itch that maybe the repertorial stuff isn't doing. Was that something like looking back on, you know, that you thought was just a different kind of path, something that was maybe somewhat unrecognizable compared to the typical path?
That's interesting, and I haven't actually thought deeply about that before. I think what happened to my father was what you're saying. Like, I think fiction was always the dream, and he had some early success, and then he gained a name for himself at The New Yorker as a nonfiction writer, as a writer who wrote about the environment and big business, the asbestos industry, those types of things. And I do think he kept reaching back, and he wrote other stories and other novels much later in his life. But, you know, he never got the traction back on that part of his career in the same way. But I think it was always the great love.
And as much as you might have pushed against that early on, subconsciously or even consciously, were you at all surprised that, you know, the apple of your life rolled back towards the roots of those trees?
That's a beautiful way of putting it. I mean, no, hindsight is always makes everything make so much more sense. I mean, I think, you know, I'm doing what I was always supposed to be doing, but I'm not someone who sort of regrets too deeply taking these different paths, because of course they always inform what you're doing in the present. And no, I mean, it's not surprising in hindsight, although, you know, it's as we all do when we see, like, in our siblings or something, go a very different path. I mean, DNA just has such a strange way of trickling down. So one person gets the sort of business obsession, one gets the artistic obsession, and what parts of nature nurture fall in to create the self.
And it's one thing, of course, to be a voracious reader and devourer of that kind of culture, but then it's another thing to want to, you know, pick up the pen and sort of contribute to that as well. So at what point do you realize that you want to start, you know, writing yourself and putting your own stories down, whether that's fiction or ultimately what would become, you know, Wild Game, this memoir you write?
Well, I mean, my first step was sort of becoming part of the literary world. So once I realized that this was my passion and I was really sort of in this wrong place in my life, wrong town, wrong career, wrong man, all that sort of stuff. And I, in this sort of bold move, kind of changed everything in my late 20s. But I entered the literary world, and I started, I found a literary magazine with the filmmaker Francis Ford Coppola, and I did that. I love that. I did that for years. And, you know, initially, I think I was quite in denial of my own desire to write. So sort of discovering new voices, helping new writers along was really my passion. And then I continued that into book editing, and now I also run a literary nonprofit. But I think, you know, I was writing at various times along the way. It was always sort of part of what I was doing. While I think I was sort of keeping it on the back burner in some ways, or not making it public, like I was very impressed and surprised by people who, you know, boldly announced that they were writers, even whether they had a book out or not, or anything published or not. They just knew that that was what they did. I was pretty shy about it. And I think part of it was it took me so long to process the events of my life, which later became this memoir, Wild Game, that I think I was figuring out for much of my life how to tackle the subject matter. And in my 20s, I did write some sort of very earnest and overwrought short fiction about it. And later, I tried to write it as kind of with humor. I think I used humor to deflect some of the greater pain that was involved. And so it wasn't until fairly recently, and I did do other writing along the way, but it wasn't until, you know, maybe longer ago than that, but I realized that I needed to write it head on in memoir as directly as possible. And I think that's simply because, you know, the longer you tamp down a story or you deny a secret or one of these profound moments in life, I think the more power it has over you. And so it was almost the only way to take back the power.
How did you find that the courage and the will to actually tackle it head on and not come at it with these other deflecting tactics. You
right.
know? How did you
come? Well, one thing that really sort of urged me forward, frankly, was having children.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, if you know, having children requires revelation, and there had been such a legacy of secret keeping and deception in my family, and it was when I realized, you know, I hadn't done all the work that I needed to do on some level when I had children, and sort of having these, my past and the future collide in these present little beings, that I realized I needed I needed to break that cycle and have that pattern end with me and in my, you know, and who knows if I'll succeed, but that was in some way, that was the moment that I realized I needed to write this in a different way than I'd been thinking about it beforehand.
Yeah, there's that really you know, touching moment late in the book when you give birth to your daughter, and there's, and as I was reading it, I'm like, like, what's the connection Adrienne's going to make between her own mother and then the fact that she is now a mother and everything, and that whole, you know, that sort of mental calculus as you're probably holding your newborn daughter, be like, you know what, this is not going to happen to you the way it happened to me.
And honestly, it was that physical moment. I mean, I have always had a close bond with my mother, for better or for worse. I love her dearly, despite our very complicated past together. But when I gave birth to my daughter, I was in Mass General Hospital. I literally remember coming up in the elevator, sort of on the gurney, you know, with my daughter in hand, and those doors pinging open, and there was my mom. And I had been so excited to introduce her to her first grandchild. And it was such a shocking and physical response. I mean, it felt like I had an elephant sitting on my chest. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't speak. I'd never had, you know, what I imagined was some variation of a panic attack. And it wasn't until sort of this very capable and efficient nurse sort of sent my mother back to the waiting area and took me in, and I was like, what the hell just happened? And but it felt like a collision. It felt like just this pay attention to what's happening. You know, this is a moment. And it reminds me, I don't know if you've read that book, The Body Keeps the Score, but it just felt like I just had a physical reaction, you know, to this moment of my life, this collision of past and future.
Mm. You know, early on too, of course, you know, for people who might not be too familiar, what happens is, you know, you're 14 years old and your mother wakes you up, and then what happens?
So my mother woke me up when I was 14. The setting was Cape Cod. We were in our family home, and she at the time was married to my stepfather. And she woke me out of a sound sleep in this sort of desperate moment, like, wake up, wake up. And she told me that Ben Souther, who was my stepfather's best friend, had just kissed her. And I remember just this moment of understanding, even though I didn't understand neither of us understood that she was going to go on to have this epic love affair with Ben Souther. But even in that moment, like in real time, I understood that there was a before and after in my life, and I had gone to bed as my mother's daughter, and I'd woken up, and I had become overnight her best friend and her confidant, and would become a co-conspirator in this love affair. And I got incredibly enmeshed in all the details, because of course it was, you know, for most people, you know, their thought bubble is probably like, good God, how horrendous, which, you know, as now I'm the mother of a 14-year-old myself, and I can totally agree. But at the time, of course, it was very seductive and very exciting, and we all want our mother's love and attention, and I suddenly had my mother's love and attention in a very real way. And you know, it was also a whole lot more exciting than, you know, say, spin the bottle on the beach. You know, we were in a real, live, grown-up drama, and you know, I've said this before, but I liken it to kind of a mother-daughter version of Thelma and Louise. It was like I was, you know, behind the wheel of the getaway car, and she would come careening in with some, you know, close call, and I would jump on the gas, and, you know, it was very exciting.
I think on the surface, and probably a lot of people reading it would be like, you know, the snap judgment is like, how could Malabar like do this to her adolescent
right.
daughter? And then like, if you just kind of like unpack it a little further, and I'm sure maybe you've done this too, it's like maybe looking at it through some empathic eyes. Like, I wonder, you know, what it was about that time where maybe your mother felt she needed to confide in her 14-year-old daughter versus maybe someone more mature, more capable of carrying that burden. Like, have you thought of that at all, just as to why it was you versus someone else?
You know, every day for 40 years. I mean, one of the great gifts of writing memoir, creative nonfiction, is, you know, you have to do it well, to write, I mean, I believe to do it well, you have to kind of loosen the grip on your own narrative, and you have to really do your best to understand what was driving other people in your story. And so one of the beautiful and unexpected outcomes for me personally was that I really did a deep dive into my mother's life. And I, you know, you can't really walk in anyone's shoes. You can't know their story really well and not feel compassion. And for however complicated my childhood sounds, and it was, you know, it was a walk in the park compared to my mother's, who had two very self-involved, domineering parents who were also, I think, both huge alcoholics, who were married to each other, divorced from each other, married to each other again, divorced from each other again. She was an only child. She was incredibly lonely. There was a secret other family that her, at least one that we know of, that her father had. So it was just, and, you know, then she had an unhappy marriage to my father. She lost her first child. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but the woman really experienced tragedy. So you can be, you know, one of the things that I was very determined was I didn't want to write a Mommy Dearest style book with, you know, bad mom, angelic daughter. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see all the gray in this relationship, all those subtle and true parts of it. And so I think why, you know, I can't begin to explain why my mother woke me up, like why she chose me. I think when I think about it, it was probably she'd had too much to drink. It was late at night. I was there. And also, you know, if we go to the sort of deeper, darker place, I think she knew that I was devoted to her. She could manage me in a way that she might not be able to manage someone else. But I think you can look at Malabar, which is my mother's first name, as sort of a villain, but it's really oversimplifying, because I also think you can look at her as a survivor, as someone who, you know, went for love, as terrible as that might sound to people. And the other part that I haven't told you is my stepfather was terribly ill. He had 4 massive strokes in 5 days right around the time of their wedding, and essentially went from the love of her life to not quite an invalid, but not a healthy person. And she took care of him. He was more child than husband. And so, I don't know. I just think it's all much more complicated than it appears on the outside.
For sure. Yeah. And given that, like, your stepfather, her love there, and then has those strokes, there are, you know, desires and needs that people have as adults and couples, and then suddenly, you know, it's sort of in the prime of her life, that thing gets swept from her, and then she has to seek that out. And you can almost understand, even though it does seem kind of, for lack of a better term, villainous, but you can kind of
right.
you can kind of go there and be like, yeah, I almost understand, because
I find the most interesting part, because that's certainly how I intended to write it, not with judgment, although, you know, there's some, look, anyone can question the boundarylessness of waking up, you know, a 14-year-old girl to bring her into it. I mean, that is problematic for sure. But whether or not you judge her on having the affair, I mean, what's been one of the most interesting things, having published such a personal book, is realizing that what I have written is not necessarily what you, for instance, have read. I mean, it sounds like it is what you read, but as I've been going around the country and on book tour and talking to people, I mean, literally, I will be introduced back to back one night to the next where one person will describe, you know, the book and my mother as sort of, you know, a feminist before her time and going for it and seeking out what she wanted and these very sort of not quite heroic, but somewhat sometimes. And then the next night it'll be no one in the history of the world has ever seen a worse mother. And you kind of, I was like whiplashing between all these people's reaction because of course we read through our own lenses. So, you know, some people might see it all black and white. I did my best not to portray it that way.
Yeah, and I think you accomplished that masterfully. And it goes to a point, too, of what you're saying is that once you have spent the time with it, it is at one point yours, and then you have to cede it to the public, and they get to do with it what they will. So what was...
And I have to say that's a challenging moment, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, so, yeah, like you're alluding to it, of course. So what was that experience like of how this story, which is still yours and every bit the thing that you grinded on for, well, 2.5 years of the solid writing, but also the past
right.
40 years of life,
right.
to then give it to other people and have them run with it? What, you know, that's disorienting in a way.
It was disorienting, but it also, like, ended up being a very positive experience. Like I felt great anxiety, of course, before the book came out, which I think all writers do, no matter the book, but especially a memoir, because you realize you're getting judged along. It's not just your writing; it's sort of your story too. And so it was destabilizing. And also, I didn't feel somehow I hadn't really anticipated the degree to which people would connect to the story itself, because of course I thought I had written, you know, one of the quirkier stories I knew of. I mean, it's not something that everyone's like, oh yeah, my mother did that too. but I think many people can relate to having a powerful parent, to the dynamics of that relationship, as well as to the, you know, the patterns that go down in families and trying to break free of them. So it was like I didn't expect to have that conversation as much as I've had and to have people thank me for sort of opening a door onto that conversation. But it has been, you know, you have to let people have their reactions, which, you know, in the beginning I kind of wanted to explain, no, that's, you know, not what I meant. I meant this. But in the end, it's all valid. So the people who, you know, some people are obsessed with my betrayal of my stepfather or, you know, how did that feel? Or, you know, everyone has a different part that they're most interested in. And I think that probably says a lot more about who they are than what I wrote.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And as you were saying earlier how, you know, you're essentially trying to write this story with the right degree of detachment so you can have more shades of gray in the story. And what was the challenge in doing that, given that it's not like this is, you know, fiction and made up where you can kind of paint those colors in? These are, you know, real people that are real close to you. You yourself, of course, are a character in this too. So when something is as real and true as this, what becomes the challenge for you as the writer to step back and write
right.
with that detachment that you need to tell this true story?
Well, I think one of the gifts that I had, which not all memoirists have, is, you know, a significant amount of time to process it. I mean, when you look at people, I for instance, am in awe of Dani Shapiro writing Inheritance almost in real time as she discovered that her father wasn't her father. She was writing this book. I couldn't have written this book in real time. This took a lot of maturing and being away from it and processing. And, you know, some people can write grief books about loss or addiction or whatever else. So I think that the thing that was helpful for me in this book was really that marinating time that that I had thought about this for years, not necessarily a book, but what in the writing of it, it was almost this way to know how I thought about it, to put down in words, to finally sort of express how I had always felt. And it was really a study of getting every right and true word to match those feelings. So it was a very satisfying process once I was sort of had my butt in the chair to do it. You know, a lot of people have asked me, you know, was it incredibly painful? Was it reliving? And, you know, it was all of those things, but mostly I found it very helpful to put it down as exactly as I wanted to, as I needed to, and to express all the nuance of it.
Did you, where did you, if you did, like over the course of the writing of the book, did you find yourself, pumping the brakes in various areas where there was a resistance to wanting to dive into a certain, you know, rabbit hole that you're eventually you just like, no, I gotta be more unbridled here?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I think I've always sort of thought, both, you know, as an editor as well as a writer, there's sort of two, I'm sure there are many more kinds of writers, but if you were just sort of, you know, making this loose separation, there are writers who sort of go down absolutely every rabbit hole, you know, so they write just this sprawling, you know, there's no thought that doesn't make it to the page, and then all the work is in scaling back and finding the thread of the story and seeing the through to the end. And then there seem to be the writers who, you know, if they don't outline, they have a very specific idea of the trajectory of the story and then kind of, you know, build upon this sort of skeleton and flesh it out and flesh it out and flesh it out. And I'm definitely more of the latter than the former, although, you know, there was a lot of stuff I wrote and just throughout, because one of the things that I think most memoirs try to do is, you know, it's not autobiography. It's not every single thing that happened to me. You know, as I wrote in the author's note, like friends and lovers are edited out, like whole swaths of my life aren't in there. This is a shaped and crafted story. It's true, but it's like one little piece of it. So my guideposts were just sort of always keeping the focus on this particular relationship. So I didn't go down a lot of digressive paths with, you know, other relatives or, you know, I mean, I included the people who were part of the story itself, but I tried to hone sort of closely to just that piece of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, because you do have to, you know, zoom in and be super selective. And as I was reading it, too, I'm like, I suspect her father probably played, it was more prominent in her life, but this isn't
that story. Oh, yeah. I mean, father, brother, stepfather, step-siblings, they were all there. But, you know, the part of it is that, you know, this book is ultimately about keeping a secret, about storing that and what that did to me. And I mean, I think one of the most complicated parts of keeping a secret, of course, is that it keeps you from being known or authentically known. So whether that's with boyfriends, friends, lovers, teachers, whoever, you are holding a whole side of yourself in there. And that, you know, that didn't involve, I mean, it involved all those other people in as much as I was keeping the secret from them, but it was just the dynamic with my mother that I wish to explore in this book.
In what ways did harboring the secret start to really poison your life and maybe even infect those around you too, as this thing was
right,
kind of rotting you out from the inside?
Very graphic way, but yes, you know, I think it was Jung who said, you know, secrets are like a psychic poison. I mean, they very much are, and it's just sort of what I said. You know, I imagine it's like someone who always knows they're gay but can't tell people. I mean, like, how do you actually have a best friend if they don't know something so fundamental to your life? This was the most fundamental. This was sort of my seminal story. And, you know, the other thing, which may or may not be obvious to people, but, you know, it's one story. It wasn't like this was the only secret in our household. Like, so, you know, my brother had his, I had mine. It was, we grew up in this environment where it was the norm. And so I think it has taken, you know, it took a huge act of will at some point to say, this is not the life I want. Like, how do you undo something so fundamental to your upbringing and your family history? As I said, my, you know, my mother discovered, both my parents had a half sibling they didn't know about as children. You know, so there's, this really goes back. And then how it continues to exist, even though I feel on the one level like I've done the work between talking about it, reading all sorts of stuff, being in therapy, those types of things. But there's this story at the end of the book, which I just love, because it just, you know, this is where you can't undo everything. But after my father-in-law, so I'm happily married. I have two children. My husband's from this lovely, very functional family, which is foreign to me. And when his father died, we all descended on my wonderful mother-in-law. So there were 6 siblings in my husband's generation and 15 grandchildren. And we all show up and we're all telling stories and all this. And at one point, one of the adult grandchildren finds a locked stainless steel box in the basement, and he rushes this up, and it's put on the dining room table or the kitchen table, and everyone in this room greets this as, like, great news. What could be in the box? You know, they're just beaming. They're excited. It's like a message from beyond, and I alone am thinking, like, what is wrong with you people? Like, this is not good news. And I have a toddler at the time, and I'm looking at my husband thinking, like, good God, get this box away from your mother. Are you all on crack? What's going on? I am convinced that something disastrous, like, they all worship this man. Like, we are about to find out about some disgusting fetish, some illegitimate child, some lovers, like, whatever it's going to be, like, none of us want to know this. And I'm breaking into a sweat, and they're, you know, they go from bobby pins to, you know, a crowbar to open this thing. And of course it pops open, and out come all these love letters that my father-in-law saved from my mother-in-law before, during their courtship. My husband just looked at me like, you know, what is wrong with you? And so that's my paradigm. I mean, that's the way I view the world. Like, I don't think I will ever find a locked box and think, this is probably good news.
Right.
I mean, it's just, you know, that's one of the legacies, right?
Yeah. In the book, too, you write that I was 27, but I felt so much older, as if the best years of my life had already slipped past me, not fully lived. And at that point, how do you go about reclaiming those years that you thought you lost?
Well, slowly, right? I mean, I think I don't actually, you know, it's funny hearing you read that line, because I do remember feeling that, and I no longer feel sort of the regret from it. I mean, it's the life I had, and I am in a good place. And I, you know, in that way that I think when I reflect on the past, I think if any one of these threads were different, you know, my whole life might be different. Like, it's sort of dangerous to sort of say, yes, if only this didn't happen, then I could have had another life. I mean, I like where I am. I like what I do. I love my family. But you know, I don't think anyone escapes difficulties in life or tragedies. And I think, you know, we process them as best we can, and we get through them slowly. But I think you have to face them to move on successfully. I really don't believe putting the blinders on and proceeding is successful for many people.
Yeah. And I think that parlayed into this other part where you write the thought of pursuing a creative life in whatever way
I could made me happier than I'd felt in years. And it goes to what you said earlier about trying to find that agency in your life. And it finally happened, right?
Oh, it absolutely did. I mean, one of the things that I'll say about my literary career is that, you know, I mean, during much of it, I never made a whole lot of money or anything else, but I have enjoyed pretty much every day of my working life. I mean, you know, there are obviously bad days and so on, but like, I'm doing something I love and something I believe in, whether that was as a story editor, a book editor, running Aspen Words, which is the nonprofit I run. I mean, it's so fulfilling giving voice and attention to stories and you know, seeing how they help people. I mean, hearing other people's stories is sort of it. Sharing stories or sharing our humanity. So it's all such a positive. It's been such a positive way to go through life for me. You know, other people want to do, you know, whether you're a doctor or what have you. But I think finding a thing that you love to do and actually sort of enjoy walking through each day is, you know, what could be better.
Yeah, and you helped shepherd, you know, four stories that would win the National Magazine Award for fiction. So that must have been just an incredible experience to be, you know, the person who helped develop these stories that went on to, you know, gain some cultural traction.
Oh, it's been so great because, of course, now Zoetrope is, God, is it 30 years ago, 25 years ago? But it's so wonderful, like these writers whose first stories I published have now won, you know, National Book Awards and Pulitzer Prizes and, you know, are the writers on Game of Thrones or whatever else. But it's just, it's very exciting and lovely. And I think, you know, all of us who work in the literary world, you included, you know, the more citizenry, the more support of one another, I mean, it all helps all of us, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's I think there is a mindset, probably more early on than later, when you feel like, especially if you get into like a comparative, almost toxic, jealous kind of mindset where you kind of look over your shoulder and you're like, oh, why is that person doing this? Like, I wish I could do that, or I feel like I'm capable of that,
right,
and I'm just not getting the opportunity. But I think maybe the more you develop, you realize, oh, when Gia Tolentino is writing this and it's brilliant and beautiful, and if Adrian's doing this kind of thing and you're inspired by it, it means like,
yeah,
oh, they did that, so maybe if I just work hard, I can do that too, not they're
absolutely
taking something from me.
Absolutely. And the fact is, you know, I mean, I so firmly believe, look, there is definitely natural talent, no question. But boy, so much of it is just working hard. It's like you're in a courtship of, you have to show up and write. I mean, you know, it's not just sort of waiting for inspiration for the, you know, that brilliant book, you know, just drops into your mind. I mean, you have to be there and usher it through and work hard. But yes, I think, you know, none of those authors started out writing brilliantly, right? We muscle along, and then you turn up. I mean, you can even tell this in your own initial drafts. I mean, first drafts are generally bad for a reason, and then it's just so magnificent to shape sentences and see them emerge and squeeze the most out of every word, and, you know, all of that.
Yeah, and you said muscling through, and I love that. I love that sort of that image. And when you were writing this book or any of the other, you know, essays you've written over the years, you know, what does the muscling through a draft look like for you?
I mean, I can tell you I'm starting something. I don't even know what it is yet, but just, you know, every day, just you save that different file that's slightly different and slightly different. So let me just step back and talk about my process a little bit. I mean, when I started writing Wild Game, so, you know, I have a job, I have elderly sick parents, I have two children. Like, it wasn't like, oh, gosh, I've got plenty of time to do this.
Yeah.
I actually magically had, I went on a residency. So for 2.5 weeks, almost 3 weeks, I was really allowed myself, which was, you know, guilt-inducing and everything else, to take time away from my family, to take time away from my job, to just go and immerse myself. And I got a toehold on the book, you know, then. I heard the voice. I figured out the essential framework, which I'd been, you know, had been in my brain a long time, but, you know, down on a page. And I wrote several, the early chapters of it. And then when I came back to New York and got home, I remember seeing a writer friend who's very successful and writes beautiful novels. And but she, you know, she doesn't really have to work and she doesn't have children. And she also happens to be, I think, a Buddhist priest. And she was like, yeah, all you need to do is write every day. And I remember my thought bubble was just like, what are you talking about? Like, there is no part of my world that I can write every day. But I realized she was right. And I started not with any grand idea of writing for hours a day, but I usually got up at 6:45 to get my children sort of bed and off to school. And I started getting up at, you know, 6:30 and then 6 and then 5:30 and then 5. And somehow touching something every day is really important to me. It just connects me very solidly to the material. And then once I'm super connected to it, then it's like everything I absorb in the world, from the walks I take to the books I read to the conversations I have, are all filtered through, you know, my thoughts about the book. And it's like sort of a net in the ocean. I'm able to sort of collect the things that I need from my daily life that then when I touch it the next day, sort of infuse it somehow. But muscling also is just like when a paragraph sucks, you know it sucks. You've got to just sit down. And you're longing to go on, but you have to figure it out, and you have to make, you know, in the end, you have to make every word sing, which is not easy or pleasant all the time. I mean, it's one thing to sort of get all the ideas down, and that's bad first draft, but then the muscle part to me is in the editing, is in the just pushing through and not letting yourself be lazy or not. And sometimes you need friends and readers to help you with that, because we can all have a blind eye to the sentences that are bad. But usually when you have someone go through it and sort of put check marks where something isn't as good, you're always nodding your head. You're like, yeah, I knew I was letting that one, just hoping for the best there.
There's something very empowering about even just doing a little bit every day. I've even set, you know, just a timer for, let's say, 20 minutes, and
absolutely,
just do what you can in 20 minutes. You, for one, you'll be surprised how much you can get done in 20 minutes. And then it becomes sort of addicting. That flywheel starts, and you're like, I can't wait to get to the next 20 minutes on the next day. And it has this Newtonian momentum to it.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like it's almost, you know, I suppose this is the most benign way or boring way of putting it, but it becomes a habit. So right. In the same way that if you run every day, you don't feel well if you don't run, or if you meditate every day, you really miss it if you miss a day. That's how I felt about writing. And actually, when I was finished, I mean, it took me a long time, because at that point I was getting up at 4:30 in the morning. It took me a long time just to shut those characters up, who, like, I would wake up and they would start talking to, you know, it was sort of, I'd been in the head of that book for 2 years. And, you know, I kind of just thought they'd know they were done. Yeah. But they did not. They talked for a good 6 or 8 months afterwards. It is a habit. And of course, we all have such a finite amount of time, you know, but you have to give something up. I mean, unless you really don't need to work and don't have children and sort of lives that are complicated and everything else. But for most of us, you know, if you don't have enough time, how can you make time? Well, you give up television, or you give up your morning trip to the gym, or you don't drink from 9 till midnight anymore, whatever it is. You know, it's simply, it's a decision.
And what was the, you know, for someone like yourself who coached and edited a lot of great writing along the way, and mm-hmm. what was that moment like for you to give yourself permission to write your story, given how much you are giving of yourself to other people's stories?
Yeah, I think part of the reason I was able to write Wild Game is that I wasn't actually sort of actively editing that in that time. I mean, I love the fact that I'm still in the literary world, but I'm doing something entirely different than I did for much of my career, which is I'm still sort of supporting writers, but I'm not as sort of immersed in the creative process with other people. And I know some editors are able to do that, but I found that to do that piece of my life, well, it is such a creative act to edit and to be as involved as you need to be to help someone, because you essentially have to really put their helmet on your head and see the world of their novel or their memoir or whatever you're working on with them. And it's a pretty exhausting, or, you know, depleting in a lovely way, but it's, you know, if you're doing it well, you're giving it your all. And I certainly didn't have then room beyond that to do my own writing. And the other thing I'll say is I was able to read so much more also after I left editing, simply because, you know, when you're editing, you're reading so many manuscripts, so much stuff that you probably aren't going to be able to publish, and you're responding to that. And I think my reading of actual books probably tripled or quadrupled once I left publishing, mm-hmm. which sounds counterintuitive. And then the only other thing I'll say on that point, you had said something earlier that reminded me of this, but I don't feel like I felt as much, it was less feeling competitive or jealous of people's success, but I was daunted by how incredible some of the writers I worked with were. So the internal critic in my own head would be kind of like, you're not going to be able to write like that, like give it up, Dorothy, kind of thing. So, you know, I think we all battle whatever insecurities we have, but the problem with working with great writers, and I've had the opportunity to work with, you know, many wonderful writers, is just you sort of think, well, I'm not, you know, who am I to think I can do that?
Yeah, and that becomes the challenge too, because that self-critical voice will keep will stifle you. So you have to dance with that fear.
Yes, you just do. And just to, you know, I just reminded myself time and time again that everyone, you know, every writer I know seems to feel this way, and by that, I'm including the great greats. You know, they're like, I think this is the worst book I've ever read. Or, you know, the next day, this is brilliant. Like, right? Yeah. It's such a mercurial, I'm a genius, I'm an idiot feeling.
And given that you have such a robust experience as an editor, and then, you know, and then making the transition to write your own book, how successful were you, or, you know, how did you take off your just inherent sort of editor hat? And it's that way it wouldn't get in the way of the generative process of getting the drafts done.
Yeah, it's curious, because of course the common wisdom is just write, you know, what my son would call a sloppy copy. You just get it all out, get it all out. And I am not quite that kind of writer. I mean, I think in the generative phase, you have to be loose. You have to allow yourself to go down the wrong path a bit, to, you know, to just spill. I'm not, you know, and then the editing part is definitely cleaning up the mess.
Right.
And I tend, you know, the editing part of my brain will kick in pretty quickly, so I do need to quiet her as I do this. Although I will say that my personal process, I am not able to move off of something that is too rough. Meaning, if I don't feel like I've got the scaffolding right in chapter one, it doesn't need to be perfect or beautiful, but if I don't feel like I've got that right, it's very hard for me to move on to chapter two, just for structural reasons. I just need to feel very sound in that I've kind of got it mostly right, and then I can move on. Which, you know, I'm not recommending, because I think probably there's a lot of to say for just writing a freer, you know, start to finish effort. But that's not easy for me to do.
Yeah, that's structure was in my notes too, and I wanted to get your sense of how your approach to it as well. And to that point, it's like kind of alluding to it, like that, you know, you need a rung on the ladder to kind of climb to the next one.
Absolutely.
At what point do you confidently come to the ending of your story? Like, do you kind of know where it's ending? Early in the process?
In this case, I did not.
Yeah, okay.
Which sounds crazy because it's a life story, right? So it seems like, you know, well, that's one of the things memoir has going for it. You know the story. But the fact is you don't. You know, this book could have ended with the marriage, with my children, you know, with my mother's health. There's sort of all sorts of different places it could have ended. What I know is that... or people told me I wrote a very sort of almost novelistic style book, and I will say that various scenes were always incredibly clear to me in my mind. So I you know, one of the complicating parts of writing a memoir is, of course, you have this grown up voice in your head telling you how to feel about the events that happened to you, and you know, so you want, at least I wanted to actually write those events, especially the early events, without my 50-year-old self intruding and telling the reader what the lesson was here.
Yeah.
You know, I had to shut her up and go from these scenes that were powerful for me. Like, I always knew I would start with my mother's kiss and that night of waking up. I always knew, you know, certain, like that dinner with my future in-laws, you know, that is one of the most powerful evenings of my entire life, the wedding scene, the necklace, like these moments I knew. So it was sort of arranging the furniture of the book in that way. And obviously this is mostly a chronological book, but then the decision of when to let the wiser, older me come in, when to keep her at bay, all of those things were really studied efforts in the end. And so if my book is broken up into three parts, the first part is arguably where I was a child and relatively blameless. And the second part is when somehow of my own accord, I made my life more complicated. I leaned in when I should have leaned out, which is one of the areas I was most interested in, which was, why was I so, you know, moth to flame on this whole thing? Because I created some of the drama later. You know, I was interested in, I understand why I might have done this at 14, but when I was 23, why was I still in there? And then, you know, the third part is sort of me reclaiming my life. And so sort of seeing them in distinct ways was also helpful to me. And I do think it's important to see a book, you know, in its parts, and to understand what experience you're giving the reader as they go through it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and it gives. Yeah, it's giving it that shape, that sequential nature, and these sort of thematic chunks gives us, you know, something to glom onto, and also just shows you as a character moving through this, you know, this period of life. So like you were saying earlier about not being autobiography, like this is how you were able to structure it through this, you know, this telephoto lens looking at this particular
right.
chunk of life.
And yeah, and even if your reader isn't aware of that, I mean, you have to be in control of the narrative in the end of a book, of course.
And of course, too, this, you know, this, I think anyone who has, you know, self-involved parents will definitely, you know, connect to this. Both of my parents are self-involved in different ways, but definitely very self-involved.
Yeah.
What's your relationship to that? Like, given that you saw, you know, the way your mother was in that detachment, then becoming a mom yourself. So what was your relationship to, you know, self-involved parents, and how did you end up ultimately breaking that cycle?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a very conscious decision, and I think I spent much of my life working on it even before I had children. You know, just who did I want to be? Did I want to be an honest person? What does that mean? All those things. But, you know, with having children, of course, you know, we all parent either in reaction to or replicating what we liked in our own parents. And, you know, my parents had a lot of great qualities too. I mean, they really were big personalities and lived in the world and lived large and you know, lived by their own rules. And some of that stuff I truly admire. In my own, with my own children, you know, in reaction, I would say, is I am very conscious of boundaries, of wanting to be their parent and being wary when one has the impulse to be their friends. And I hope to be both of their great friends someday when they're adults.
Right.
But it's funny, you know, having a 14-year-old girl now, what I see in my daughter is, of course, this very intelligent, graceful, mature, you know, to all outward appearances, this girl looks like a woman, and she's sensitive and she's sweet, you know, and I can totally understand the lure of wanting to talk to her about stuff. I mean, you know, I get it. But the other thing about having a daughter at 14 and writing about, you know, a self who was 14 is, of course, we remember 14 really differently. So it's been such a gift to actually see that despite how she looks and how she behaves, she is also a child. Like, she is so young. She's, you know, can be so serious, and then you see her skipping and with a bunch of stuffed animals on her bed, and you're like, okay, yes, this is a child. And so, you know, that is kind of just a marker for me is never, you know, obviously I'm not worried about doing the same things that my mother did, but sort of, you know, just having clear boundaries of what I tell her about my own current feelings about things. You know, like if I were mad at her dad, like that is not something, you know, that's grown-up stuff that I need to handle on my own, those types of things.
Oh, that's great. Well, Adrian, this was, you know, so great to get to talk to you about your writing and the process and, of course, your wonderful memoir. And we're kind of up against our time. So I just want to, you know, ask you, you know, where can people find you online to get more familiar with you in your work and maybe connect with you online and get more familiar with your stuff?
Absolutely. Well, I am on Facebook. All of these things are just my name, and Instagram, Twitter. I'm going to admit I'm not a good tweeter. I make efforts, but it's not my natural. I don't know. I don't handle the pithy sound bites that well. And I also have a website at adrianbrocher.com. But I love being in touch with readers. And thank you so much for this interview. It's been great.
We did it. We made it, CNFers. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure you're subscribing to the show, of course. This crazy show is produced by me, Brendan O'Meara. Hey. I make this show for you. I hope it made something worth sharing. And if you really dig the show, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Show notes are at brendanomera.com. Follow the show on the various social media channels at CNFPod across them all. Get that newsletter at my website. Win books, win zines, hang out with your buddy B.O., once a month, no spam, can't beat it. Are we done here? We must. Because if you can do, interview, see ya!